Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Andrew Sellen, who is currently appearing in the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company production of Vanya and Marsha and Sonja and Spike. I think I got that right. And also in the Oslo Repertory Theatre production of Philadelphia, Here I Come, and also in the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company production of Grapes of Wrath. As you will hear him say, working at the Oslo now is truly a repertory company, and the actors are truly getting a repertory experience. But you will also hear Andrew's personal life experience, which is really interesting. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Is all about being who you really are. It is my belief as a psychotherapist that most of us are living a life which is a version of who we really are, but rarely the entire truth of who we really are, because things happen to us in our childhood which discourage us from expressing certain aspects of ourselves. Perhaps this is a familiar thing to you. Maybe you even know something about yourself which you had to leave behind. Maybe there are family stories about you and what you used to do, or jokes about you, or about another member of your family. Maybe you can see it in someone else, not in yourself. Someone who left their sense of humor or their assertiveness or their talent in one way or another behind. Maybe you know someone with a wonderful voice who really loves to sing but only sings in the shower and won't. Or you know somebody who you know writes poetry but won't let anybody see it. Too many of us suffer some embarrassment or assault on ourselves in our childhood, either in our family of origin or in school, or in culture, in our culture, which thinks something about us is not attractive. Or maybe it's just the fad of the time. You know, maybe you have straight hair and curly hair was in when you were a girl. Or maybe you have a big ass and straight skirts were in when you were a girl. These things can force us to be embarrassed about ourselves and to hide those aspects of ourselves which we think are not going to get us what we want, which is what everybody wants, which is approval, affection, inclusion, love, security. So we come out of childhood having jettisoned, hidden, sacrificed, forgotten, sometimes really important things about ourselves. And that's a great shame, because later in life we quite often need precisely those things which we have felt necessary to hide, leave, deny. The good news is that while you can deny it, you can't lose it. It's still there. It's recoverable. It's not as simple as saying, oh yes, I left that behind. My pride in my writing, my delight in the way I could put words together, I left that behind and now I can recover it now. Because whatever it is that made you leave it behind is still there too. So if you're interested in trying to recover something you lost, or you just want to talk about the whole issue of loss and recovery, you can talk to me about that. You can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. At the website, you can click on Contact Me and ask me any questions you like. You can talk to me about psychotherapy on the telephone, which is how I do it these days. You can read my article about psychotherapy on the telephone. You can find the first chapter of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can find all of the shows I have ever done, including all the interviews, including the one I am going to air for you today. And that is, as I said in the run-up, with Andrew Sellin, who is one of the ensemble actors, one of the repertory actors at the Oslo Repertory the Oslo Repertory Theater Company this season. And Andrew is so articulate, and he has so much to say, not only about his own evolution into acting, which is in itself interesting, but about comedy, what makes something funny, about what a serious, honest, I believe is his word, actor does when that person is playing comedy, the way to show the pathos behind the comedy, the real person, not just the caricature or the cartoon. So, as I said, Andrew has a lot to say, and it's a long interview, so I don't want to talk any longer. I'm going to let Andrew tell it to you all by himself. Here now, Andrew Sellin. Okay, so I'm here interviewing Andrew Sellin because he is starring with the ensemble company of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike.
Yep.
I want to start by saying that you were terrific.
Thank you.
I believed you every minute.
I really appreciate that.
You know?
I aim for that. Funny or not, I aim for the honest, and we'll see where it falls. But I'm glad it spoke to you, because I love this play. Durang accomplishes so much, and he accomplishes such a variety of clever and sneaky, subversive little shifts in the course of this play. You start out with one thing, you think it's going to be, oh, that's what it's going to be, and then he takes you down all kinds of different alleys.
Yeah.
And to me, what I love most about it, especially as a Chris Durang work, is that of all the works that I know of his, this one has such a passionate heart to it. And very funny, but it is really pulsing with something that he clearly feels strongly about. And that gives all of us so much more to play.
Well,
so
and you get to be his voice.
Ultimately, yeah. In a way, I do get to.
Oh, I think there's absolutely no question about it. I mean, you know, he said, and now I'm going to tell you why I did this and what I think. You know,
Vanya kind of does end up being, the heart of it.
Yeah.
Or maybe the soul of it, I'm not sure. And it's something our fabulous director, Peter Amster, who I'd worked with once before, so I already knew he was brilliant, but it's something that we really worked on, because we both saw the New York production and we loved it, but we were both like, but there's a lot more pain mm-hmm. going on under here.
Yes.
Particularly for Vanya.
Yeah.
And that it's dazzling as that Act Two moment is, it's not all about laughs by any means.
Oh, God,
and
no.
We really, really wanted to just dig in there and say, no, this is a man who has lost his way and can't find his way out.
Right.
And it's interesting because I was listening to or watching a little video of a Chris Durang interview. And one of the first things he said in the interview was that he is chiefly interested in those moments in life where comedy and pain intersect.
Wow.
And I think that speaks very much to his canon, and it certainly speaks to this play, because
yeah.
you're laughing, but by the same token, there is a pit opening up underneath.
For everyone.
Exactly right. It's a wonderful, wonderful play.
It's a wonderful, wonderful play, and how long is it running?
We are running through April 13th.
Do not miss it if you can help it. So now, what I do is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art,
mm-hmm.
and it's clear the art you're making your life with is acting.
Yes.
And I only ask this one question, which is, do you remember how it started, the very first moment that it looked intriguing, compelling, attractive?
If not yet inevitable. There is something, it's reaching quite far back. Surprisingly far back. First theater I saw was actually at Jordan Marsh Department Store in Boston, and my mom took us in to see a production of The Emperor's New Clothes. Now, why it was being done at a department store, I don't know, but I was a kid, I didn't ask. I was like, oh, okay, what's this? And I saw this production, I was like, okay, this is insanely cool.
And
this
how old were you?
Oh, I was quite young. I probably wasn't more than, like, I don't know, 6 or 8 or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I was pretty young. But
yeah.
I got the gist of it. I got the story, and I loved everything that was going on, and I was fascinated. And then later on, my sister, she had a friend around the corner, and that friend and her put together some sort of original play. And they were having trouble casting this one role, because it was all about, you know, some... The man, the dark and brooding man of the house, who was being played by the older sister in drag. Because they're just, you know,
yeah,
the
right.
guy's willing or available, or maybe she just wanted to, I don't know. And they weren't able to find anybody to play the little daughter, who was like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 or whatever the kid was supposed to be. And they were really stuck on it, and I just said, well, I can do it.
Oh, my God.
Like, where that came from, I don't know.
Wow.
And my sister was like, it's a girl. And I was like, I don't care. I don't care. It's a person. I can play a person.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what she's, you know, trying
and so
to
what
say.
You're
and do
8 or
scene.
10 or 12?
Yeah, I was pretty young.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was, you know, the kid brother.
Yeah.
Who was just tagging along.
Right.
You know, and I was like, oh, no, please, can I do it? And they're like, really? You know, you'd have to wear a dress and all this sort of stuff and be a girl. And I was just like, sure, I don't care. And, you know, I did the scene and I just thought, okay. That was cool. And then again, it just sort of went away for a few years. In middle school, it was, like, incredibly uncool to be doing theater. At least when I was growing up, it was just not a cool thing. And so, for whatever reason, peer pressure, whatever, I kind of kept to the sidelines, and I didn't really do anything until, oh gosh, freshman year of high school.
Okay. But you remembered.
I remembered. It's like these little little things. The show I saw when I was a little kid at the department store, and then this little play in a basement that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then I got to high school, and my mentor there, this fantastic English teacher and drama director named Betty Jane Williams, or B.J. Williams, they were having auditions for a production of Twelfth Night. And I thought, oh, Shakespeare, cool.
Had you read Shakespeare?
Some, yeah. Yeah, my parents were really into reading and getting us to read, so mm-hmm. we were a bunch
of... So you weren't scared by it?
No, not at all. I was just eager. I was just curious. Like, okay, da-da-da. And I was like, Twelfth Night, wait a minute.
God, yet again.
Exactly. Like, how did this happen?
I can do this.
That's exactly right. I'm like, well, I can play Malvolio.
That's right.
And I just told myself, I can play Malvolio. And so I went in there and I auditioned. You know, I was new to the school. I was new to everything. And I hadn't done it in middle school. I'd watched other people go up on stage and do shows. And I'm like, isn't that weird? And I hadn't just said to myself, why don't you just do it?
Yeah.
And when I got to high school, for some reason, at whatever age I was as a freshman, I was still like, no, I want to audition for Malvolio. And I auditioned, and I got it. And I did it, and got a lot of great feedback for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were like, okay, how is someone that young able to wrap his head around Malvolio? But I don't know, I've always been on an odd wavelength, I find. One of the first professional gigs I got was a production of Brigadoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was auditioning for the role of the sidekick, Jeff,
mm-hmm.
who's a real wisecracker. But I looked at the script and I'm like, Jeff is the best friend, but Jeff is also clearly a high-functioning alcoholic. The
mm-hmm.
man can knock him back and hold him and still be articulate and witty, but there's no question that he's an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and I auditioned for the role of Jeff. And the stage manager called me later that day and he said, well, we'd like to offer you the role of Jeff. That's the first time I've ever seen Mordred play Jeff. And I think that informs him. But to me, it's, you know, it's like so many characters. I did production of 1,000 Clowns. And I played mm-hmm. Albert, the boyfriend of the young woman, who eventually ends up, of course, with the leading man. And they're both, Albert and the woman are both social workers. And in the show, it's very clear that it's there's comic stuff going on with Albert and stuff like that. But again, I took him seriously. And he really is embarrassed that this love, this would-be fiancé,
right.
is clearly drifting to someone else, and he's in the middle, and he doesn't know what to do with it. And he does some physically awkward things and stuff like that, but it's coming from a place of, oh, gosh, this hurts.
This is,
you know,
every one of these is Pagliacci?
I don't know.
But you know what I mean.
I do. A laugh,
you know,
clown laugh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that the pathos...
Well, it's back to that Durang thing of that's when it really grabs you, is that nexus of pain and comedy.
I would guess that lots of actors who play comic roles don't see that, don't put that in, and it's a loss, really.
Yeah.
But it's easier to do the...
Well, yeah, it is, and I see that a lot, and it's, you know, it happens. People make their choices, and sometimes audiences love them and laugh, and that's fine, and I understand where humor... is supposed to be in a well-written script, but I also feel like you have to organically get there. Eventually the humor comes out.
Right.
But, you know, Peter Anster, our director, makes a wonderful joke. It's like,
right.
you know, and he said, well, ask yourself, what would a person do?
I love that.
Because that's really what it comes down to. If you have a moment, you know the playwright wants you to get a laugh here, but you have to go back. You have to go back and say, I have to be honest. It's like the old Lunt-Fontanne joke. At least this is apocryphal, perhaps, but they were doing a play together, and one night he asked her character for the cup of tea and got a huge laugh. And he went back every night and tried to get that laugh again and kept not getting a laugh after
right.
that. And finally he said to her backstage one night, he's like, I don't understand. That one night I got this brilliant laugh here, and I haven't been able to get it since. And she said, darling... It's because you're asking for the laugh and not for the cup of tea.
Yes,
and
yes,
that's
yes,
in
yes.
a nutshell.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
I was amazed because that production of 1,000 Clowns turned out that the woman who was playing the female lead was the goddaughter of Jason Robards.
Oh my!
Yes, who was in the original production and the film?
Yes, right.
He came to see it.
Oh my God!
So this man came up to me after, so I was like, "Oh holy moly!" That's Jason Robards. And he was so sweet. He was like, I just wanted to tell you, I've seen this play more times than I can count. Thank you for playing Albert like a real person.
Oh, how
he said, because
lovely.
He was twice as funny.
Oh.
And I said, well, thank you. That's exactly what I feel I'm trying to do when I step on stage. Yeah.
Okay, so, backing up to this first production, it's Malvolio, right?
Yes, yes.
Right? And you get...
The response was great.
Now, is this from the... students, from whoever, from the
everybody,
audience, from the teachers,
everybody,
from the...
even the resentful students, I could tell.
Wow! Wow!
And that's it. It's like when you're the uncool kid who's doing theater, and you do something, and everybody's laughing, and afterwards they're like kind of embarrassed because
they didn't
they
get
enjoyed it.
It. Yeah.
And
oh,
they did.
And
they did enjoy
no,
it.
No, I don't mean that. I mean they didn't get that you were so good.
Right.
They didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They're late.
Yeah.
In the
you know, I was. I update. You know, and it's also it may well be one of those things where everybody around me knew I was gay long before I did. You
oh,
know?
How amazing.
It could also be a part of that, too. But there was always sort of a, and I think, you know, there may be elements of why I often end up playing characters who are slightly outsiders.
Yes.
And that's, as
and
an actor, a
well,
very exciting yeah. place to be.
Yeah, and how well you know it.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, so, yippee, then what happens?
Oh, you know? After the yippee. Oh.
Yeah, right. Are you surprised when this happens, when you get all this accolade?
I don't want to sound disingenuous. Of course an actor goes on stage for applause and for the response, for the completion of that, because it is. It's all about identity. But all I knew is it felt right. Mm-hmm. All I knew is that being Malvolio with that wonderful cast, they were really wonderful. I mean, for a high school production, I can't tell you how good people were. They were just, and BJ was a fabulous director. And I was just like, all of this feels real and right to me. Mm-hmm. And I love this reality. This is amazing. Let's do it again.
Right. So we have Let's Do It Again, but do we have Could I Do This for a Life yet?
It did happen in high school, actually, the transitional moments. And, it's, you know, I'm trying to think, maybe it was junior year, I guess. I think it was junior year. Yeah. So that was freshman year. And I just, after Malvolio, I just kept doing stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even remember all the stuff I did, but I just kept trying to get on stage and play different characters. And a couple of interesting things happened in high school, that which was very telling, because there were going to be auditions for a production of The Mousetrap. Mm-hmm. Now, in The Mousetrap, of course, as most people on the planet now know, almost everyone's seen it, there is a character named Christopher Wren who is extremely flamboyant, and if the word gay is not used, it is certainly implied in his mannerisms and his behavior, and he is actually really rather unpleasantly mocked by the man of the house when he's not there. And I wanted that role. And I didn't think anything about me, the role, this, that. I thought, no, I can really get that guy. I can do a good job with that guy. And the most bizarre thing happened, and it's maybe the only time in my life when someone has given me advice, and I took it, and I really, really regretted it and backed down. But they gave it with the best intentions in the world, because I was also playing the flute in the band. Head of the band called me in one afternoon to his office, and I'm like, I was such a goody-two-shoes. The concept of me having done something wrong kind of wasn't on the menu. So I was like, okay, what the heck?
Right.
What's this about? And he closed the door and he said, I just wanted to have a talk with you because I've heard that you want to audition for this role in this Agatha Christie play. And he said, now, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I think it would be a mistake for you. I think people would make fun of you. And he meant the best.
He really, truly meant the best.
But I thought this story would speak to you.
Yes, it does.
And I was like, oh, holy moly. And I went home and I talked to my parents, and they were like, okay, we see what he's talking about. They didn't say anything specific, and I wasn't putting it all together. Right. But I got the gist of it. It's like, oh, there, everyone's going to think that I'm whatever that is, even though I hadn't really picked up on the gay word yet. And I was really bummed.
I bet.
But I instead, I spoke to BJ, who was directing that, and I auditioned, and instead I ended up playing Major Metcalf. Mm-hmm. And this young man who was very straight and whatever ended up playing Christopher Wren and, you know, screamed his way all over the stage.
Yeah, right.
And I just looked at it, and I was just like, okay.
What a shame.
It may be funny and this, that, and the other, but it wasn't real to me. And I don't know how real I was in a wig and trying to smoke a pipe and trying to be a, you know, 50-year-old retired general or whatever the heck Major Metcalf was. So it was one of those things where it's just like, huh.
Yeah.
And I had to live through the, you know, whatever it was, 2 weekends or 3 weekends of that production, knowing that I had made a choice that I wasn't happy with.
You sold yourself out.
Yeah. Or tried to protect myself from something without even...
That is selling yourself out.
To be honest and to be fair, when you're a teenager and you're getting stuff like that waved at you, and believe me, I didn't know the G word, and it was more the F word when I was a kid, and I got that thrown at me a lot, a lot of times. So I knew darn well that people were kind of thinking that, and when that band director said that to me, I thought, I don't need any more of that pain in my life now. He's not wrong.
No. Well, and he may not have been wrong.
Exactly. But what was interesting was after that experience, I sort of just stepped back and I'm like, okay. And then sometime after that, we were doing Peter Shaffer's comedy, Black Comedy. And there happens to be a character in there named Harold Gorringe, mm-hmm. who is an antiques dealer.
Uh-huh.
Who dresses extremely faily, mm-hmm. with a big flower print shirt and the whole nine yards and all this sort of stuff. And I just thought, I'm going to be Harold Gorringe. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it. And I auditioned for it, and I got it, and I went for it. And interestingly enough, you know, I'm sure some people were looking back and saying, well, he's just being himself.
Right.
I'm sure a lot of the bullies would like to have said that. But in a way, I was being myself. I was being honest, and I was being honest about who this man was and what he wanted. I was not playing a cartoon.
What this makes me think is that having accepted that advice taught you a lesson you could not have learned in any other way. So in an odd way, it highlit for you who you have to be.
Right, whoever that self is
that's right.
Forming.
Well, and at that age, really pretty much the most important thing to us is not to be, to stand out and
right.
to be...
The whole peer thing is
right.
so devastating. That affectless is never a good choice.
No.
Participate,
right.
even if it hurts. And that's absolutely what high school and theater certainly taught me. Probably time for me to answer the question you asked a while ago. When did I know
yeah,
that
right.
I wanted to do it professionally? And that happened, I guess it was at another point in junior year. I was rehearsing as one of the four barbershop guys in a production of The Music Man
mm-hmm.
in the auditorium. And then on breaks, I was running across the hall to the cafeteria where we were rehearsing a production of The Importance of Being Earnest, in which I was playing Algernon.
Oh, wow.
So I was being a tenor in, you know, Music Man over in this room, and I was being Algernon across the hall. And things got a little hairy,
mm-hmm.
but I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I came home from a day of school and rehearsals at one point, and my parents, who again were just the most amazing people, sat me down, and they just said, we've noticed that the amount of time you're spending doing theater is beginning to greatly outpace the amount of time you're spending on homework. And we just wanted to say that we're concerned about it. And I said, well, are my grades suffering? And so they said, no, honestly, not yet, but we're just worried that it might.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I seriously don't know how or where I found the words, but I just looked at the two of them and I said, this is what I want to do for my life.
That is my answer.
I practically do, because they said, okay, we're going to need to think about this.
Oh, and, good for them.
And, right. They just pulled back and they kind of
right.
looked at each other.
Right.
And they're like, okay, we're going to talk about this again, but let us go away and think about this a little bit more.
How remarkable.
You know, because
they should have given parenting lessons.
Honestly, they mm-hmm. were, you know, they were amazing. And they said, you know, no, we think you're serious about this, so let us think about this. And so I went on rehearsing and doing school and all this stuff with these two shows going on, and then they found a time another time after my dad got home from work one day, and after dinner we sat down and we talked again, and they said, okay, we'd like to make you a deal, because we honestly believe that you're good and that you want this. But we also know, from what we've heard, because neither of them was in the theater,
right.
That it's a really, really hard life.
Right.
We'll be okay with you continuing to do all these shows and things like that if you agree that you will go to summer school and take a typing class. Because if you're going to be an actor, you're going to need a job that actually pays the bills, because theater almost certainly never will.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can type, whatever, but at least it's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably have to move to New York, and before we let you move to New York as just an actor, we want something in your back pocket.
That's remarkable.
I know. It's like, wow.
That is remarkable.
But they were. They were remarkable people. And they were just like, that's the deal. We will not harass you about any of the theater that you're going to do if you will agree to do this. And I said, absolutely, sign me up. I'll do it. You know, and so I spent the summer as the only boy in this secretarial pool, you know, of trainees typing. And this is back in the old days of, you know, typewriters.
Right.
I feel like Vanya now, but it was.
Right.
It was we
right.
had typewriters
right,
back
right,
then,
right,
and that's
right.
what it was. And sure enough, it got me work when I got to the city. And from there on, I taught myself word processing and then got into better and, you know, da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
But it all started because my parents had enough forethought to say,
well, and what's so interesting
you know,
to me about this is that most of the other parents that I have heard who give this sort of ultimatum give it with, but you have to major in something in college, like, you know, teaching or
yeah.
nursing or something, you know.
Right.
I mean, your parents were so smart.
Because you're absolutely right. It was just a remarkable thing to have them say, we had hoped that you would be a lawyer, you know, like your dad. And I was just like, it doesn't speak to me. I don't know what that is, but I don't feel a connection. And they were like, okay, we believe you.
So essentially what they were saying was, we had hoped that you would turn out to be this, but we see that you are something else.
That's right. And just accepted it, right, flat out.
Right. And that, the gift of accepting who the child really is, there is nothing more important than that.
It's so true. And being gay, I've heard so many unhappy stories of people coming out and...
Well, it isn't only being gay, being in theater.
I know, right?
I mean, come on. You know, are you kidding?
In either of those professions, you can sometimes end up on the wrong side of...
Yes, of your parents' wishes
family,
for you.
Family,
yes.
Absolutely. People have agendas for you that you sometimes don't even know.
Well, more often than not, you do know. And you know that if you don't live up to it, then...
You become aware and you either keep batting up against it...
That's right.
...or you come together.
Right.
And
there's always a price.
Yeah.
You pay a price. Even if you go against what they want and you honor yourself, there's always a price. The important piece here, which I really, if you've listened to any of my stuff, I really like to stress, is the support of family and of school, because family can support you and school can take it away. I mean, a teacher can destroy in a heartbeat.
Absolutely right.
You know?
Absolutely right.
So you were extremely lucky.
Unbelievably lucky.
Yes.
And I literally, to this day, am so thankful.
Yes.
Because my parents could not have been more remarkable and more consistently supportive, you know? And literally, my dad only passed away in 2010. My mom died many years ago. But in both cases, right up until the time they died, they were supporting, and what are you doing next, and what's going on, and they wanted photos, and, you know, the whole nine yards. Just, you can't buy that.
This is terrible what I'm going to say.
What?
I'm going to say, it's what you do for love.
It is. It is, because loving is accepting.
That's right. That's exactly
right. It is absolutely,
right.
That's the package, and I've learned that in, you know, my husband and I have been together for 20 years now. And again, I don't know where it came from. And I've never done this before in my life, and happily have never had to since. But I literally went across the room, walked up to him, said, hi, and, you know, introduced myself, and kind of just, it was probably a pain in the ass of myself. And after the party, we were standing out on the street corner together, and I said, would you like to trade phone numbers? Because I'd really like to see you again. I've never done that in my life. And we have been together since that night. And you can't see, it's, you know, it is the old Some Enchanted Evening lyric.
Yes, I know.
But it's true. It's just like, it can happen. You can look across a room and see someone.
And know.
Without a thought in the world.
Right.
It's just there's something about them that pulls you, and there is a truth.
I believe it, absolutely.
I'm certainly a believer now, to be sure.
Okay, so now, did you go to college?
Yes. Yes. I went to Harvard undergrad.
Oh, I see. So, I see. Really? In theater?
No. That was part of the irony.
I see.
As Captain Hook says, that's where the canker gnaws. Because at that time, in my era, Harvard took a very dim view.
Yes, I'm thinking.
Theatricals.
I didn't.
Well, I mean, there was the hasty pudding. There was this, there was
that's
that.
Right.
It was all extracurricular.
Yes.
And the concept of actually having credited courses for theater.
Please. No.
I was told very clearly that wasn't going to happen. But you know what? I really do believe strongly, and I know that Lucy says something similar to you. I believe undergraduate should be about broadening your scope and your education.
Right.
So I didn't really want to go to Harvard. I chose to go to Harvard not just because my eldest brother had already gone, and my mother would have probably fainted if I'd said no, but because I knew it represented such possibilities.
Yeah.
And I loved to read. Here we are in a room full of books. I loved to read so much.
Right.
Books, plays, anything.
So what did you major in?
English and America, the official title, and I don't know how they squeezed it onto the degree because it's the smallest English, old English writing. It's English and American Literature and Languages. And I did the honors track, so it was just scary amounts of reading every week.
Yeah.
On top of sneaking away and doing theater. And I royally pissed off one of my professors, you know, who really, he was on his tenure track already, and he was already dressing like a 50-year-old man, even though he was in his 30s, and he was bound and determined that I should be like him.
Oh.
And he really, really gave me a hard time straight up through my thesis. And I just thought, how sad.
Really?
He seems to think he knows who he is, but he isn't getting who I am. And
no.
I know who I am at this point. So college for me was great because I wrote, I acted, I performed. Oh my gosh, I performed tons. Some of it obvious stuff. I got to do the MC in cabaret, which I'd love to do again. And, oh gosh, lots of things. Well, I got to do the two big Anthony Newley roles.
Stop the World,
I Want to Get Off. That was the first show I did there. And it's so funny, so many things, life comes at you in such so many surprising ways. So many of the best gigs I've gotten as a replacement.
And that being one of them?
That was one of them. The guy, a woman from Belmont High School, who is now at Harvard, was directing the production.
Right.
And she knew I was a wonderful actor because she had directed black comedy and some other stuff.
Aha.
But I wasn't a great singer back then, and I didn't, you know, it just wasn't, not at that level, because that's a tough show.
Yeah.
And there was this other guy who was a total triple threat, and of course, he got cast.
Right.
But I knew he wasn't as strong in the acting, which was the one thing where I was strong,
right.
And he could nail me in the other two. And then, for whatever reason, he, right after accepting it, turned it down. So I'd already gotten the phone call to tell me that I wasn't going to get it, and my roommates, who, of course, were still new to me, I was just devastated. And they were like, but you came so close. And I'm like, that doesn't count. In this world, if you're not on the stage, you don't exist. You know, everything at that age is so passionate. And then, you know, like the next day, Debbie called me back, and she said, well, okay, you're not going to believe this, but this other guy pulled out. And honestly, I'm thrilled. Would you like to do it? And I was like, are you kidding me? And when the reviews came out, they were like, yeah, his voice needs work, but you can't take your eyes off him. And I thought, good, at least I'll work on the rest of it.
Yes, no, they got what you had to give.
Well, again, I looked at that character of Little Chap, and he's not even a very nice character. He's insanely selfish.
Right.
But the point is, when you're playing him, you can't say, I'm insanely selfish.
Oh, no, no.
You just say, what I want, and that's, to me, that's how you can let the audience in on someone who isn't likable. And to give them a chance to say, oh, actually, that is kind of like me a little, you know, dot, 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 and let them finish the picture. So that was actually a really good, demanding role. Yeah, out of my league singing-wise at that point, but a great training experience. And we were a huge hit. We ended up extending and all this sort of stuff. So the woman who was playing opposite of me, we were both freshmen. And it was how did this happen? And suddenly we were doing stuff all over the place.
And did you then study voice more?
I did start studying more and doing more musicals and ended up doing a couple of productions of Jacques Brel.
Oh, my.
One in English and one in French.
Oh, my.
Because I also speak French. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it's weird because the songs, the English translations of most of them are entirely different from
the
French.
Yeah, they're wrong. Right, they're not right, 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 right.
And Cabaret, the MC in Cabaret.
Right.
Which is not an easy role at all.
No.
Not an easy role. But great fun. And I wrote a couple of musicals. I wrote a show that didn't get accepted for the Hasty Pudding, so I produced it myself with my roommate. And then the next year I wrote one. And that was a difficult time because that was around when my mother died. So over the same summer I had submitted a Hasty Pudding show and my mother died suddenly. And I was dealing with all of that. And then I get this call telling me that
they'll do it.
My show had been picked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was going to play in Cambridge for a month and play in New York for a week and all this sort of stuff. And it was very bittersweet calling my dad to tell him.
No
very
kidding.
Bittersweet. It was, our heads were kind of wrapped around a lot that summer. But it was amazing. And that was an amazing growing and learning experience, too. Because I love writing. I did book and lyrics, and I love writing lyrics especially. And I still do. I still do. And then I wrote another show after that, which I think was a little too outre for them, so they didn't pick it again because it got serious.
Oh.
I thought it was time that maybe the Hasty Pudding could do a show that had all the yucks and the laughs and the guys and dragons, stuff like that, but ultimately had a serious, rather pacifist. But it was sort of like both about pacifism and also about taking responsibility. And, you know, not quite frothy fair they had in mind. But that's okay, because it was on my track. It was
that's
on my
right.
trajectory of where I needed to go as a writer.
Right.
So we produced that one, too. So I did, you know, I even designed a couple of shows, because that's another thing. I do believe that the more an actor knows about all aspects of the business, the better. Hands-on understanding of what it is to make that happen every day, every night, whether it's props or costumes or whatever. So I designed costumes for a couple of shows. And it was funny, the senior year, finally, that was when Robert Brustein and the ART folks came over to Harvard, my senior year. Mm-hmm. So finally, there was suddenly a full year course, not in acting yet, but in design, which I thought was interesting. So I took this full year design course, because hey,
yeah, right.
It was with some awesome professionals. And so it was a whole, you know, whole year of doing costume, set, and lighting design with people. And that, again, just sort of opened my horizons and helped me just say, okay, well, if I was designing, if I was directing, how would this world look? How would people live in it? Is it practical? And being an actor, I would always be looking at, yeah, okay, it's a great idea, but is it practical to put on a stage?
Right. Am I going to trip over it?
Right. And is it going to work for the audience? Are they going to get the metaphor or whatever it is that you're going for?
Right.
You know, I designed a production of Hedda Gabler, where, you know, the drawing one room set, drawing room set, with this very florid sort of Victorian wallpaper, but the walls were all clear. So you could see the maids and the people coming and going behind Hedda as she was in the room. And in the center of the room was the entranceway with some big blood-red curtains. Mm-hmm. And behind those curtains, on an inner wall, a foyer sort of wall, was the portrait of the father, sort of looming over things. And so everything you see, you're always seeing that Hedda is never private. She is suffocating.
Right.
Because society is literally all
encroaching
around her, everywhere. And when she goes to kill herself at the end, the only place she can go is to the portrait of her father and close the curtains.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, a very well-known set designer was the teacher for that, and he just sort of sniffed at it, and he was like, see through walls? And I'm like, yeah. There's a metaphor going on here. I think it's appropriate. Yeah. He didn't see eye to eye with me on a lot of things, but I thought my designs had, you know, had resonance for the work,
yeah,
and that's
right,
what I'm always
right,
looking
right, right.
for. The choice is always about, is it serving those words that playwright chose to put on the page?
So, you do everything.
Well, I'm really an actor. I'm on a roll now. In the last 2 years, I seem to be playing like 5 different preacher roles, and I don't know what that means. You can help me process that.
I don't think I want to touch that.
Exactly. But it's so funny.
Although, actually, I think that's wonderful.
Well, it's just interesting the way, you know, business, it's such a business. They see you certain ways, and there's just something about me and my long face that says preacher to people.
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about all of the plays, about Philadelphia,
oh, these,
about
Fania, that we're doing? Sure.
Right, and about Grapes.
Well, they're all amazing plays to begin with. They've picked such an incredible season for actors and audience.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's Michael's vision of the American character.
The American character, and particularly this year, the American family. And I think they're great, great choices.
Yes.
Because Philadelphia, I was speaking at the Out at Oslo session for Philly the other night with Michael. And I talked to my husband a lot about this, too, because he saw the production when he was here recently. And it's such a powerful play.
Oh,
it's hilarious, but it's also devastating. It's teetering, again, between comedy and pain, comedy and pain. So you get a lot of very, very funny things going on, but your heart is breaking, too.
Yes.
For
all of them.
The central, everybody.
For everybody.
Everybody.
Right.
And it's an amazing look at a family, and it, you know, to speak to what you and I have been talking about, the price of silence.
Yes.
The price of not just saying, this is who I am.
Right.
Please, talk to me.
Right.
Who are you? Let's mm-hmm. meet somewhere in the middle. You know, the back and forth between the father and the son.
And the son.
It's, those silences are just devastating.
Yes.
You know?
They are, and they're more common than
oh,
the
gosh.
Opposite.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And when you see it on stage, then you get to reflect on the price, if that's what's going on in your life.
Right, right.
You know?
Exactly right. You know, is this, and if anybody out in the audience, and I think it does, I think people out in the audience, if they sit there and go, oh gosh, that's my family or something, I hope if there's time, they should go back and do something about
that. Do something about it. So then,
That's Philly, that's Philadelphia,
right.
Here I Come, which really is, it's such
it's
beautiful,
a beautiful
writing.
Yeah.
You see a whole community on that stage in little snippets, and it's amazing. And it's funny because the canon, in some ways, is the only happy man in the play.
That's right.
Because in that little small town, he's got power, and he can draw the line where he wants to. And if things get too emotionally close, as they almost do at the end of the checkers
that's
game,
right.
the canon simply chooses not to engage.
That's
and it's
right.
heartbreaking, but that's his limitation.
That's right.
And then you've got Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, which, you know, I've already said is so dear to my heart. And it resonates in so many ways, because you've got three middle-aged siblings who are recently orphaned.
Right.
You know, if you
right.
will. And what does it mean to be in your 50s and be orphaned? You know,
yes.
what does that mean? Of course you're grown up. Why should parents being there or not being there matter?
They
but
matter.
Of course it does.
It does.
It matters hugely. And especially if you've been close. Again, it's devastating when they're not there. And you have these three people with very different takes on the world, all thrown together, and you wonder, to me the play is all about, is there still a family? Is there going to be a family by the time this is over? And I don't want to spoil it for anybody, because I think people should come and find out what happens for themselves.
I agree.
But I think it's delicious the way that perhaps nothing would have been decided if Durang hadn't thrown in this hot young character, Spike,
mm-hmm.
who unwittingly is like, you know, the fox in the hen house. He just,
yes.
without even knowing it, sets everything on its ear. And then you add Nina, the very adorable but slightly ambitious ingenue who lives mm-hmm. down the way. And then the psychic housekeeper,
God
who's
bless her.
Prone to, you know, Greek mythology outbursts at unfortunate moments. And it's just brilliant writing. It's brilliant writing. You don't. One of the things my husband always says about good theater, and films too, is the best ones never let you see where it's going.
Yes, that's right. And you do not with Vanya,
with
for sure.
You, no.
Well, and with Philadelphia. I wasn't ever sure he was going.
No.
You know?
I've had some people come up to me afterwards and say, I'm not sure he is going.
Yeah.
So... we'll leave that to interpretation.
Right.
And now we're in rehearsal for
Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath. Michael's directing, and that's going wonderfully as well. I have to say, I have been so blessed because directors set the tone for every project. Now, I had worked with Peter Amster before because we did 39 Steps together at the Maltz Jupiter a couple of years ago, which was just an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him when we finished, I'm like, I have to work with you again. I just have to. It's selfish, but I have to. You're amazing, and you're a blast.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came up that he's the reason that I got a chance to audition for this.
Great.
And I'm so grateful for that. But that, again, was, if possible, an even more amazing experience than the last time working with him, because what's going on in that head? He knows so much, and he can adjust so much. And now I finally got to work with Frank Galati,
mm-hmm. right.
which I had not done before, and oh my goodness, how special, how fabulous.
I
and it's sort of like, these two guys, amazing. And I also had never worked with Michael, and now I'm working with Michael, and each of the three of them works differently,
yeah.
which is fabulous, but they are so passionate about what they see and what they feel, and at the same time, they will stop themselves and say, that's sort of where I'm thinking, but what do you think?
Uh-huh.
You
all
know?
Of them.
And that's what you want as an actor. At least that's what I want as an actor. I think most of us don't want to be marionettes.
Right.
We want to bring something to the table and say, this is how I see it. And if we have to arm wrestle, we'll arm wrestle.
Yeah, right.
But, and it's just been great because, and Michael, bless his heart, he's got 28 actors to orchestrate. It's epic, you know? This is big stuff. But he's so passionate about this story and telling the story cleanly and purely. And it's a wonderful cast.
Oh, it's a
wonderful cast. So, and it's fun because being in rep, I've never done true rotating rep, even though I trained at Playmakers Repertory. This is a true rotating repertory.
This definitely is.
And it's a different ball game, but it's fun because you do, I have a glancing couple of scenes with, like, Christian Kahn, who plays public mm-hmm. Gareth in Philly, but now he's Tom Joad and I'm Jim Casey. So now we finally get to hang out together and actually spend more scene time together on stage, and that's one of the joys I'm discovering about rep, is just the interweaving of lives on stage and off.
Wow.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody talk about it in quite that way.
It's fantastic. It's because everything feeds and informs everything else.
Is Philadelphia still running?
Oh, yes. Philadelphia, here's the rundown. Philadelphia plays through April 12th.
Right.
Vanya plays through April 13th.
Right.
Grapes of Wrath starts performances, first preview, I believe, is March 12th opens officially March 14th, and it closes April 19th.
Wow. So you can come and see Andrew Sellin as everything.
There you go.
In everything.
That's right. Well, we didn't even discuss the time I did I Am My Own Wife. That was 35 roles. It's like, but it's that was the closest thing to this, is where you have
yes.
to just wrap your head around.
Yes, you have to be the guy you are at the time that you are him.
In the moment.
In the moment,
acting
right.
Acting about being in that
That's
moment.
Right, right, because you can't afford in this one to let that slip for a minute or you turn out being somebody wrong in the play.
No, it's true. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's also, I mean, this sort of ties in that play in particular, I Am My Own Wife, and also to Vanya. There's also, there's another resonance going on for me because I am gay.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's right.
And those
that's
roles,
right.
That's been really revealing to me, because I'm like, a character's a character. Well, that's like my husband and me telling ourselves, oh, getting married after 19 years,
it's no
not
going to
make that big difference.
But it
And then
does.
We did, and it was the most amazing day of my life.
Yeah.
You know, and for somebody like Vanya, to be playing someone like Vanya, it's kind of ironic, because, okay, I'm a middle-aged gay man.
Right.
Playing a middle-aged gay man
right.
who lives in Bucks County. Well, my husband and I vacation in Bucks County. So I already have all the photographs. All the research was done. But it's wonderful when
yeah.
real life comes in and informs. It's great to get in there because there's stories that still very, very much need to be told.
Yes.
I'm so glad that these playwrights put these words on the page. These need to be told. People are people are people.
That's right. That's right.
Just get it out there. Get anything else out of your head, because that's all that matters, is these are people you root for.
That's right. Whose humanity you can't help but see.
And whose hope and struggle for a better life and to live their life, as you would say, as their true selves.
That's right.
And be respected and accepted for that. There isn't a person on the planet who shouldn't understand and identify with that.
No, there isn't a person on the planet who doesn't benefit from that.
If they'll let
if
it in.
That's right, that's right, that's right. Okay, so perhaps you remember, the last question I ask is,
oh,
having
dear.
Given a life to this work,
yes.
is there just anything else you would want to say about being an actor?
I'm so grateful. And I'm not kidding. Try not to cry, but I'm grateful for every chance I get.
Yeah.
Life throws a lot of surprises at you, and at your family, and all sorts of things, and nothing's a given.
No.
Nothing is a given, and everything you get is a gift.
Yeah.
Every time I get to be with other people and to create something new together, communally,
mm-hmm.
where my voice is important, but every other voice is equally important, designers, directors, everybody is on the same level and all creating one vision, that is my idea of heaven. You know.
Please, that is a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Andrew Sellin.
Well, thank you.
I told you that Andrew's was a really interesting interview. And if it didn't make you want to run right out and see him in Vanya, not to mention Philadelphia and Grapes of Wrath, then Sharon Leslie's review of Vanya, which I am about to read, will certainly make you want to run right out. With a title like Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike, you might be tempted to wonder how this could be an American play set in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It seems vaguely Russian, somewhat Chekhovian, if you know Chekhov, until you get clobbered by the name Spike. Well, in the title is the clue, the tease that grabs your attention and invites you in to enjoy the absurdist comic mind of the play's author, Christopher Durang. This Tony Award-winning play comes to the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company shortly after closing on Broadway. Using themes and names from Chekhov's plays, Durang has crafted a comic and touching piece about two dullish quasi-siblings and their glamorous movie star sister. Vanya and the movie star Masha are brother and sister. Sonia is their whining adopted sister. All three are in their 50s and facing an uncertain future. Earning a living and whether or not to sell the family homestead are the questions being pondered by these three siblings. Masha is fearful about winding down her career, while Vanya and Sonia contemplate a virginal foray into the workforce. when the whirlwind Masha comes home for a visit, bringing with her a boy toy named Spike, revelations about each of the siblings are unveiled, and new realizations blow through the family home. Part of the fun is watching what happens when they are invited to a neighbor's home for a costume party. Into this charade enters Nina on a cloud of hope and the youthful exuberance of an aspiring actress. Oh, and how can I forget one of the most absurdist devices in the plot, the dire predictions of the housekeeper, Cassandra, who is unwillingly overtaken by prophetic visions. Masterfully directed by Peter Amster, the actors get to show off their comic and soulful moments. As Sonia, Peggy Roeder is outstanding as the butterfly trying to break out of the web of her cocoon. Tyler Abercrombie as Cassandra brings a welcome energy and attitude into this moody household. As the whirlwind Masha, Anne-Marie Cousin, shows off a marvelous flamboyance that is later tempered by reality. It's fun to watch Andrew Sellin enact a mounting freedom erupting out of an aging Vanya as he finally comes out of the closet, and Jefferson McDonald brings eye candy to the over-the-top antics of Spike. Christopher Durang brings a zaniness to his storytelling that is reminiscent of the old screwball comedies of Hollywood. An element of surprise and physical humor also add to the charm. It's hard to write a good comedy that also has touching moments. Bravo for Christopher Durang and the Oslo for a terrific production.
I am out of time, so let me say, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boy. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper.